EFT basics are flying up these total inflation models. So I have to start with, very apologetically, I have to start with an apology and a confession. And the apology is this, is that I was just too lazy, slow, whatever it is, to get my title in time. So I'm one of those TBA people, which always annoyed me in workshops and conferences. Like, how can you not have these comments? But anyway, so I made up this title, which is, you know, at least has TBAs in it. So that's the apology. And then the confession is I'm not a cosmologist. I just play one on TV. And the point is that someone actually came up to me at a workshop. I do most of PhD stuff, but I'm interested in effective field theories. And someone came up to me at a workshop recently and said, hey, why don't you switch to cosmology? It's pretty cool. It was floored. I went back to my office. I went back to actually to my hotel room and started looking frantically on a Higgs PQ distribution.
Dirty, right?
It's just like, wow, I didn't know that happened to me. So anyways, but what happened to me is this paper with Cliff and Yun-Min, and I'm just a postdoc here at Pi. So the real title should be, can the Higgs boson be the inflaton? And I am invoking Hislop's rule, so if you didn't hear Cliff this morning, it's this rule in particle physics that if you have a title in a paper, actually, with a question mark, then the answer is always no. So I'll give you a preview as to what the answer is going to be here. And either one of these titles is actually the title that's...
You know, my generation, we learned about Hinchcliffe's rule because there was a preprint which was, is Hinchcliffe's rule true? Question mark.
Okay, that's just too much. That's going to blow my brain for the rest of the time. He's not afraid. I think of this is a tower. Anyway, so the outline of this talk is called, I'm going to do background basics, and then I'll talk about this power hounding that we were doing for gravity plus scalars on models, and such as Higgs inflation, and we'll also apply it to R squared inflation. Now I'll talk about, because you know, I don't just want to give a talk for 2 minutes saying, no, it doesn't work, walk away. So I want to tell you why it's interesting, why it I was excited about it for a little while, and a bit in the bad of the proposal. It's not our idea. It's just Bobby Berkowitz put this forth a little while ago. It's this nominal coupling coming in and making the Higgs possibility. But then once we develop this power counting tool and talk about the goodness and about the fact you should be excited, I'll crush all your hopes and dreams, and I'll tell you how the power counting comes in and tells you that the Higgs inflation doesn't actually work. And then I'll crush more dreams and say higher curvature inflation doesn't work, and how basically these things have severe limitations as to effect. Maybe people can make them work or model them. There will be some conclusions and limitations. So this is going to be an EFT power counting morality scale. So I don't think I need to teach anyone here inflation basics. Just to set my notation, I'll remind you I'm just using floral parameters on the here with beautiful notation. But from my perspective from particle physics, I like the fact that inflation is going to come in hopefully and solve these RRL problems because I want like to be more exciting than just a standard model and maybe supersymmetry or string theory or something, which probably have relics which have to be dealt with. And this talk is going to be talking about the most vanilla of vanilla slow roll inflation models. Something that they call slow roll, vanilla slow roll inflation. And it's going to be the most vanilla because we're just going to use the one scalar field or try to use it that we actually have evidence for, fundamental scalar field possibly, that we actually have evidence for, the Higgs. And we're going to try and get slow roll inflation. And also, of course, I'm going to have a usual Hubble, which is a certain potential with M Planck's and my M Planck's are reduced. So, I'm not sure if any two people agree. I didn't take a survey. I guess there's a DBI army, but I don't know if they're here. So, I don't know if any people agree on how inflation is coming about, but it, of course, supports the inflation paradigm, data supports this inflation paradigm. So, it doesn't specify the details, but that's why we're here, that's why workshops are exciting. People engage in all sorts of exciting speculation for slow roll scalar fields of various origins, and I think the Higgs has. The inflaton is an interesting minimal idea, and I'll field various dots, brain inflation. I don't think anyone actually talked about that. We've talked about string theory giving you inflation, a multi-field inflation model, higher derivative. So, just as an aside, this seems to me a little bit like here there be dragons. By this I mean, you know, people used to make maps in the Middle Ages, and you know, some poor map maker guy had a boring life, and his life is boring. There's no dragons around him. There's no giants around him. All his friends have boring lives. His wife doesn't let him travel, so he doesn't know anything about the outside world. And so he makes up maps, and his imagination runs wild between areas that he can't actually explore, but he has never actually been in. And he would put it in this frame, which is actually historically on some. If your oldest globe actually has this. It takes some Traconis, which is here there be dragons. It's just this phrase. Here's this unexplored region with all sorts of exciting things going on. And this is cross-cultural. Japanese also have maps with dragons around the edge of the world, although that really had to do with the dragons talking about earthquakes. So I just think it's just kind of a human psychology thing. All the exciting stuff is where we haven't directly probed. It sounds familiar because with both inflation and electric symmetry breaking, we have Higgs-Sun Stellaris mode. And here there are these scalars, right? Fundamental scalars. Scalars everywhere. Scalars from all of these different ways. Scalars just all over the place. Of course, they're hard to come by so far, fundamental scalars. But, the idea that maybe it's the same scalar gives you Higgs inflation. It's kind of a cool idea. But it could just be a sign of trouble, because there might be a scalar in either one of these cases. It could all be dragons. But don't take my word for it. No less than the same person than Nima has said that in response to them suing to shut down LHC, there's some minuscule probability that the Large Hadron Collider is going to make dragons. So there you go. Take some Draconis. It's all consistent. You're going to eat us up. So that's the gratuitous name drop. That's the first one. I was just at Fino and I learned that you have to gratuitously drop famous people's names and talks. So there's going to be more. Just wait to see that. So.
Now we're all going to be headed if we're not in your car.
I mentioned your name. You're the chair. That's all I can care about. So
you give me 5 minutes of intro.
That's right. I should put more names in. I frankly type some stuff in now. But, oh. So this is going to be very bottom-up. Just think of me as a plumber, right? I just work on part of the lyrics. And I'm just going from the bottom-up and writing down this sort of Lagrange. So we're going to consider this general derivative expansion Lagrange and the scalars coupled to metric. Here. We have a bunch of scales. We have a V in front of the potential. We have M Planck's, we use Planck masses. And we have our M's here. And as people have talked about in their talks, that M is not Planck mass, but is the scale of the last physical scales you integrate out and get this low energy Lagrange. So it's going to be parametrically lower than the Planck mass, but the P can reduce Planck mass. And this is just schematic, right? So these are just standing in for all possible tensor invariants and so on and so forth. So the first simple lesson, of course, is it's an effective field theory. So there's going to be a cutoff scale, right? All effective field theories have some regime of validity. And outside of that regime of validity, use a different theory. And so there will be some cutoff scale in theories of this type, in Higgs inflation of these theories. Well, but unitary is going to be violent. And that what's important about this is going to come into Higgs inflation and cause some trouble, is that that constraint on E will supply upper bound on what M is, because the derivative expansion, you integrated out all the new physics that was going to fix unitary, it's gone. And yet, the energy scale where unitary is going to be violent tells you that nucleus has to come in and fix unitary, right? So it's going to give you an upper bound on what M has to be for unitary to be preserved. So that's the first simple lesson. We need unitarity constraints. We're going to use them. So we're doing the simplest thing. We're expanding around a classical background solution for both our scalar fields and our metric. And we're doing just semi-classical perturbation theory, where we are collecting all of the Lagrangian in terms of just the background fields and the mass terms into the unperturbed Lagrangian, and then writing down our interaction terms in just this form, where there's an operator, where we're expanding in the quantum fields over M Planck's and gravitons over M Planck's. And we have the dimensions here just as M's and M Planck's just to make sort of genetic terms have the right dimensions. So because you're just doing semi-classical perturbation theory, these things are Gaussian, you can define a 1PI generator, and then just do perturbation theory with their interaction. And the point of power counting is that it makes clear the nature of the expansion and what you're actually expanding in. And so it tells you how well you have to reduce when you're expanding in something less than one. So we have this interaction Lagrangian from this simple bottom-up Lagrangian. And we have topology, right? You just draw diagrams and you only have your connected diagrams. And that just tells you things like the number of loops. So they just a number of internal lines and the number of vertices. You have conservation of ends in connected graphs. So each internal line has two ends, external line has one end. And then vertices with n different legs coming off them. These all have to add up. And that's just topology. It's simple. Understand that. And the graph with vn vertices just gets a factor of this form. And so it's being a little too simple here. Of course, there's dimensionless ratios varying in these constants. Remember, the potential term for the scalar had a v to the 4 scalar. So it's actually a v to the 4 over m squared and Planck squared. And of course, more than two derivative terms also have m squared over plane square is hidden in there that you have to pull out to really see how all the scales of the problem are working. And you can do that. It's not hard. So what I'm trying to convince you of is you should do this, because it just makes your life easier and you find problems very quickly and you don't spend long times doing hard calculations before you find the simple problems. So you can write down an arbitrary graph regulated in a dim ray. Just use topology and its interaction regression. Just write down what it's going to be. And you'll see how the scales all work, right? You get this factor for the vertices, you have L loops of momenta, and you have kernel lines, so you have D squared I's. You have derivatives, each of those D's is derivatives, you have a number of vertices you're summing over. And just do the calculation directly, and you get this general power kind of formula for a scalar field coupled to gravity. Now, E here is the largest energy scale. So for our purposes, it's going to be like scattering energy. But you get 1 over m Planck's to the external legs. You get a loop expansion with 4 pi, two different scales in it. And the Carver information theory, this seems familiar. And then you get the two derivative terms, which is constant. And that's going to be the nominal coupling term for Higgs inflation. Zero derivative terms just coming from the potential, and then greater than 4 derivative terms going to have that expansion in scales. So now you just look at that and you know what you have to be expanding in to expand in less than 1. Or should expand in less than 1. So it is powerful, and it is indeed powerful. I'm just going to give, there's a little digression here. Okay, so there's just a little digression here before I guess get to Higgs inflation. And the point of this digression, just so you know why the hell is the same, is why I'm talking about this. Is this is going to just illustrate to you how you just use the power kind of formula and you think of a physical question, and it leads you directly to the answer very quickly, without, you know, suffering. You won't avoid suffering at all. I suffer enough as it is. So if you want to find when in a low energy expansion, for E getting small, things would be problematic, and where you would get problems from your theory, you could worry about this term coming from the zero derivative term, right? So you have, this is the only place inverse D's are there. So if you want to ask the question, when in low energy expansion will things go wrong? And what's going to be the origin of the problem? This power kind of just lets you find the problem quickly. So you have this interaction with the right curve. We're going to focus on the zero derivative terms, such as the scalar potential. So just be like Higgs scattering without any gravity. And you would worry even more if your potential wasn't a form of phi's over m Planck's, but was phi's over b, because then you have to rescale the terms in the potential, or n is just the number of fields that have to be rescaled here. And pull out all the m Planck's. And the worst case scenario, and I am attracted to worst case scenarios, unfortunately, is that the number of times you have to rescale would be all of the scalars, and you have zero derivative terms. If you put all of these horrible things together, in a low energy expansion, where's the problem going to come from? Well, you just put all these things into this equation here, maybe put the worst case scenario, but topology, remember, is still there. It still enforces this relationship between the number of legs, and the vertices, external lines, loops for these problematic scalars. And you just put that in, and of course you find that when you use this relation, what happens is you rescale these lambdas, and you get an n, and you use this relation to trade off n's for l's, c's, so it kills all the m Planck's out here, and you just end up with this simple formula. And the whole point of this digression was just to show you that, you know, it works. It knows that you should cancel all the m Planck's, because now it's just Higgs scattering of the derivatives. And it's just this simple form, this is the amplitudes and what's going to contribute to your theory, just from this formula. And overall power of B, you can just pull out here, and it'll be of this form. And so this tells you directly what terms you have to worry about in the low energy expansion. So it's the purpose of this digression. Power of nothing will lead you to the physics. You have to worry about cubic terms, because you do the rescaling on this cubic term, and you get B's here, of course. And depending on the size of B and E, you can get into trouble in the low energy expansion. So it leads you directly to where you have to worry. And this sort of lesson, this morality tale, is now going to be to Higgs inflation, and we'll use power cutting to find where the problems are directly. Let me just remind you, we have power cutting constraints. You want to expand in less than 1. Everyone should expand in less than 1. Tell your kids. Just be aware. And I remind you, we have these unitarity constraints. We have two things right now, power counting and unitarity. So, I don't think I really need to convince people at this workshop that filter is applicable. Because it's a fact that you're here, so you think it is. But, you know, it's legitimate to ask whether it is the full and curved space, and it is, but it's definitely my second computer name drop, so let's just get there. So, people claim sometimes for black holes and inflation it's not applicable because they worry about, you know, the fact that you have observers that depend on energies are measured by different observers, and the observers are measured by totally different energies, so what do you do? But all effective field theories, even effective field theory, I was weaned on because HQET has a certain amount of frame dependence. For HQET, it even violates the Lorentz branch, choose a vector, or any quarter. And energies are used to classify what's in or out of the effective theory, right? So all you need is the existence of low energy observers, not all observers are low energy. And that comes into this adiabatic constraint, right? We need to have nice light criterion of Kuczynski. So there's the Richard listening drop number two. And you need to have this nice light criterion be satisfied. You foliate space time so that you only have adiabatic background fields and small curvatures. You only need such slices to exist. You don't have to all be low energy observers, you just need to have some low energy observers. Need to have these slices to exist. And that's going to be satisfied, of course, when we have the adiabatic constraints be satisfied because we have these time scales, the Hubble scale and mu for the derivatives of our scalar fields. And we're, the brain dead thing is to say, look, it's just an effective field theory expansion R over M squared, which is H over M squared, that has to be less than 1. Derivatives of phi over M squared have to be less than 1, too. But of course, this is the physics as to why you have to make sure that those adiabatic constraints are preserved. This is all wisdom from
excuse me.
Yeah.
I think we all agree that EFT is applicable in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, which physics is it or is it not applicable? For example, the cosmological constant problem, clearly EFT seems to, depending on what rules you choose, fail quite miserably.
You're asking me to calculate the cosmological
constant? No. Well, no. Everybody knows how to calculate it.
Well, I'll get it wrong. Yeah,
I'll
get it wrong, too.
Sorry?
Everyone gets it. Well, it's... Yeah, everyone doesn't calculate it, it doesn't agree.
Right. So you give
so
the wrong answer.
I'm saying we don't understand the cosmological constant problem.
Yeah, so I'm saying in that case, if you ask, is EFT applicable to the CC problem, the answer would be no.
Okay,
is EFT applicable to density perturbations? The answer might be yes.
I think it's yes.
Okay, and is EFT applicable to the quasi-de-Sitter expansion, maybe or maybe not, depends whether it has something to do with a CC problem or not.
Okay, I don't know how to, I mean, the cosmological constant being solved is beyond this talk. And
next week.
That's next week. No. I'm here for that. So you just have to wait.
No, I think I'm not saying that, I'm not asking you to solve it. I think I'm just asking you to clarify the title of that question.
The title of the question is simply to get the adiabatic but we're just saying that if we have background fields that are sufficiently adiabatic and they're small curvatures, then the thing you just notice, and you just write down this Lagrangian from the bottom up, you say, look, you're expanding in R over M squared. And you just say, look, that's going to break down if H over M is greater than 1. So that's like the simplest thing you can say. We can just leave it at that. But I think the physics behind that is you have to have the background fields be sufficiently smooth that this expansion will be well behaved. And that's all I'm saying.
Well, I'm really lost. Do your effective field theory include negative powers of phi or theta?
Negative powers of phi?
Yeah. 1 over theta, 1 over theta squared.
You mean the field theta?
Hmm? 1 over theta, for example, terms. You know, there's a famous paper by somebody named Cliff Burgess and all, which have a potential 1 over theta to the 4th. So there are many examples which is negative powers of theta come in, and it seems to me that...
So that's not what we're doing here. So, I mean, I don't want to say anything about that other than my name's not on that paper, so can't blame me.
So basically your question is the EFT breaking down because of some uncounting effect?
Yeah.
And the answer is no.
The answer is no, so long as you, of course, are expanding less than 1. All I'm saying. Don't take it any more than it is. So all I'm saying is that we have these three constraints. We have the adiabatic constraints, we have the integrity constraints, and we have power count constraints. We're going to put these together now.
So but then you also mentioned the observers. So I'm trying to understand how much this slice is different from...
Everyone would agree that.
Okay.
That's what happens with Truth's name drop.
All right, what are you saying? What's your point?
I just wonder if you had one more point to make about the observers.
No, I'm saying the people that make this point about observers are confused. That's what I'm saying. You just need the existence of low energy observers. And then I even mentioned kind of cavalierly that there's many examples that we use to calculate things very exactly, like theories of the strong interaction, and we calculate like crazy in there. And we have all sorts of effective field theories that break Lorentz invariants and you might worry about equivalent issues. And all you need is the existence of low energy observers. And it's perfectly fine. So that's all I'm saying is there have to be some low energy observers, and there has to be some nice slice of foliating space-time so the background time dependence and the curvature dependence is weak enough that you can actually do the expansion. And all it boils down to is that you can expand in this, it's less than one.
But you want to make a correspondence between the energy that you have in your sites, the field value. Is that true or not?
Energy that I'm... So, oh, you mean E and H? No, H is going to be calculated just from potential as such, just converted to...
Because we know that energy beyond some scale, the theory is not unitary. So that's,
yeah.
That's the calculation that you can...
That's the calculation we're going to do.
That's right. But then you got to make a correspondence between the energy scale and the field scale or H scale or something like that.
No, I mean, H, I'm just going to calculate from directly from the potential.
Just from that same curve.
Well, just directly from taking this curve.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll look at that.
Wait,
you
see.
Yeah.
So, the Higgs. I don't know why I mean. Well, anyways, it's Higgs inflation, so I guess I should tell you that this is the possibly fundamental scalar field that actually seems to exist in nature. And LHC is X-fib. I mean, maybe it'll surface.
Yeah, well,
why? So, but Tetron is data, and what do we know about the Higgs today? Well, this 3-inverse centipartite data is looking for the Higgs through H-strong. And it's not finding it. So all it's doing is it's taking these usual things, these usual blue line plot you've seen where it's the delta chi-square, like data fit, and Tetron is coming in, this is results from Jupiter, and saying it's even more not there and not there. So it seems like it's light, and if you get away from it being light, your fit goes bad, even worse than it was before. That's all that's happening really from Tetron so far. But this is, of course, the only fundamental scalar field that we can drag kicking and screaming and believing might actually exist with experiments. And all we really know is it's disturbing the light, which makes no sense. And it has unknown properties other than it seems to couple the W's and Z's in the matter that Gaussian precision data is sensitive to. But we don't know anything else about it. In particular, we don't know this question about gravity, which I'll get to. But we don't know really anything about it. And in fact, we're not even going to learn probably at LHC whether or not it's coupling fermions, is giving mass to fermions, because you have to measure basically this process, and it's very tough going. I worked on that, it doesn't work either. And it's self-coupling, you have to measure 2 Higgs production at LHC, and that's even worse than this. But what's a very interesting question, which comes to the Higgs inflation ideas, is that you would have thought, I would have thought, that you probably would never know, you would never ever know what is coupling is to gravity. And what's exciting about this claim was that the prospect of adding this term to the Lagrangian, two bad terms, a rather minimal thing, the claim is that it could lead to inflation if you have it exceeding this large number, sort of one. And we could know in our lifetime, right? Because LHC was planned, as you'll see from other people's work. The idea was that it would relate to properties of measuring accelerators, weight, measure perspective index, and such. And that is potentially very exciting, even the lifetime of the older members of the audience. Oh, who's the oldest person here? We would know. So, who is the oldest person? I can't guarantee it. I'll tell you all. Drop dead tomorrow. I don't know. But, you know, that would be exciting. It would be great. But it's not our idea. And we'll see what the problems are. So, the genealogy of this, I'm sure it probably goes back further. But there seems to be some paper starting in the mid 80s about it. And then there's this beautiful paper by Bond in 89 doing all sorts of good work on this idea of nominal coupling. And there's also unraveling papers at the time, it's also good work. And then they looked again in the 90s when the data started to come in. And then what really happened, which Bishop Berkowitz put this forth a couple of years ago, and it's, you know, people argued against it, people argued for it, and it kind of caused a little bit of excitement, I would say. And there's actually a day where I don't know if this is coordinated, but it probably was, that Wilczek and collaborators and Shpishnikov and collaborators put a paper on the archive. And it was actually one after the other, so I emailed Cliff. All exciting. So that's what led us into it. But there's been some work on it. So I'm not going to cite everything everywhere or everybody, but you know, I'll try and mention what people did. And everyone here knows, of course, the simple example. Just the Higgs, of course, the usual center of Lagrangian doesn't work. This pi to the 4 term would be dominant. And you can work in slow parameters. Everyone here can do this. Take your amplitude of density perturbations, and you can just work out directly that with this number, you get that the self-coupling is going to be ridiculously small, or if the Higgs mass is just dominant, there wasn't that 5-4 term, the Higgs mass is very, very small. So that's certainly not the standard model of Higgs sitting in electric precision data. But the non-minimal coupling case is this small change, right? You just add this extra term here, and all things considered, this really isn't too offensive. And if it's effective field theory, right, you have to write down everything that corresponds to the symmetries of the theory. And you can argue that this term, of course, would be induced if you were to normalize the theory in curve space for the same sort of reason. So really the argument is what the heck is the coupling of this, not whether it exists or not. If you really think that seriously is an effective field theory. But to directly analyze this is a total pain. And this is all discussed in this beautiful paper by Vaughn. There's extra derivatives here, of course, with the five fields, and so those equal time commutation relationships are screwed up, and the second derivative is around, so you can rip it apart. So you can get into trouble defining test factors, you can define your commutation relations. You can solve, you can just do it, but it can cause some trouble. But to minimize suffering, everyone uses this wild rescaling for the Einstein framework. You just rescale the metric, basically to get this canonical rescaling. So you get your Einstein free potential rescaled by this factor here. And what's going to happen is going to be, I mean, this is the punchline, which is that when you go to large field values, this phi to the 4 term here is going to start canceling phi to the 4 term here, and this is rescaled by the constant that you'll see that this potential is. So it goes basically flat, and you get large field values. And that's exponentially flat potential, somewhat naturally coming about. And the skulls are, well, I mean, it's natural in the sense that it's playing against two terms, right? So it's natural, like, to pick a kid and strap his head to a board and let him grow for a long time, then his skull would grow naturally to be like this.
It's natural.
And you strap his head to a board, but is that natural or not? I mean,
So is there any motivation for why the coupling is not order one and it's going to be this gigantic 10 to the 4, which is...
Why is the kid's head strapped to a board? I mean, no, I mean, why? I don't know any intrinsic reasoning that would tell you what the size of that coupling is. Right?
Well, you restore a symmetry if you go to the conformal case, right? I mean,
yeah, so there's the value of minus 1/6 that restores conformal symmetry, but that's, you know.
Well, as long as the mass, only if V were 0, right?
Yeah,
right.
I think there's a mass you don't get conformal.
Yeah, as long as the mass is going to symmetry.
So, yeah, okay. But there's the only special value you might imagine has to do with conformal symmetry, I would say. It could be this number. All we're going to say is, if it's that number, we don't know these properties of this field. So, if it's that number, what's going to happen? And this is something that's interesting.
What's so special about this term in respect to higher, other non-normalizable operators for phi suppressed by the Planck? Since, after all, in Einstein frame, that's just what it is, like, it's a modification of the potential by terms suppressed by the Planck.
Yeah, you could argue that this term, just because it's a phi squared times r, you might start to think about it before you think about other terms. But of course, there'll be other higher derivative terms. If you want to do things consistently, you have to put them all in.
No, we're just saying that it's not, what I'm talking about is not higher derivative terms. I'm saying that once you go to Einstein frame, it's clear that that term is equivalent to adding non-renormalizable potential terms.
Yeah.
Because
on which you have no control, right? Because you are going to have infinitely many suppressed by n Planck. So in a sense, that term is not singled out in every sense as the most important one.
Sure. I mean, I would think that's a reasonable statement. I mean, when you do the frame transformation, it doesn't change the physics. So you could argue, if you think about it not that way, but you think about it in this way, you want to maybe think about that term first, but I think what you're saying is totally correct. It's not, you know, I mean, you'd have to write down all other terms.
These guys aren't excited to be even very large, so it's not, we're thinking of this logic of being suppressed by a Planck, right? So they single out one operator and multiply by a huge coefficient, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's other operators, absolutely.
But what I is that probably the assumption that only psi is very large is not very stable under the limited operations.
Of course.
Now, of course, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, but let's just continue with this game, you know, just taking this, just see what happens, just do the simplest case, right? So you do that Keeler definition, and, well, actually, you have to do a Keeler definition, because the Higgs field now is non-canonical. So you just can do a Keeler definition to this chi field, and, you know, it's easy to do, you just integrate some mathematics, you have hands and such, but all we're really interested in is the large field that exceeds larger than one. So you simplify this to just this very simple transformation. It's just an exponential relationship between the canonically normalized field and the non-canonically normalized field. This is what I mean by exponentially flat. You stick this in to the Einstein frame potential, and you get a constant, and then exponentially suppress corrections, right? So you expand into small exponential, and you get small exponential change to a constant. So as natural as those skulls were, it's natural. Right? So that's the story. And you can calculate, and people did calculate. So not other people calculated the slower parameters and the compared experiment. Right? So they just calculate the slower parameters, just algorithmic. They take 60-fold of inflation, and then they calculate for Higgs inflation the spectral index, and the scalar defense ratio of running the spectral index. And it's okay. They find that the data from WMAP and this is all consistent. And then they take the data and they take the amplitude-mix perturbations, and then they find that's where this large number comes from. Basically, they find, they measure this, the potential. They then use this to find what XC has to be for this to work. And then they find this classical solution. So if it's this large number, they say it's already amplitude-mix perturbation. Okay. So that's what people do. And then what happened at the end of last year is people were actually doing two-loop running. It's pretty serious, right? So they were taking, because the point is that I was saying this is classical here, right? So what you're really doing is you're relating things in accelerators to low energies, and you want to relate them to high energies. And so you have to do two-loop running, or you have to do loop running, and people can do two-loop running because it's been worked out for like 23 years for relating cell coupling. And so they did that, and what you have to worry about, of course, is that you want to have that the Higgs mass isn't too heavy because it'll actually hit the lambda pole early, and then you can't, run all the way down from these low energy accelerator experiments up to inflation energies. And the Higgs lower mass bound, of course, is metastability, but this is actually the experimental lower bound that's been put here. Metastability is a little lower than this. So you want to sit in this window, and electric precision data says you seem to be sitting in that window. So people did the two-loop beta function, Polchek and Simone and Hertzberg did this, and Fischenthal and Berkowitz did that. That's what kind of got me excited. And it gives a relationship, right? Because you have now the Yukawa coupling, so you know the top arc mass, you know about the other couplings. So it gives a relationship between the top arc mass for measuring better and better and better. Effective field theory is coming in, STT is working on getting better and better measurements of that. And also the self, so these bands here are just ranges for the strong strong coupling. That also is being worked on by effective field theory, and it's getting better and better. So you get a relationship between the top quark and what you have for alpha s and the Higgs mass, which all measure low energy experiments, and then you can relate that to the spectral index. This is the result that they show. And they show other results that come about from the running relating these different parameters. And this band here is like, I think, the expected sensitivity for Planck versus the expected sensitivity for the Higgs mass. And I think they did like 0.2 for the Higgs mass. I think that's a little optimistic. But anyways, it's real science, right? It's predictions. You measure these things and it tells you what this is, and you do this totally different experiment, you find it.
That would be math value, that would be below this curve.
That's right.
But that would be math value. It's below this curve.
I don't know off the top of my head, but I do know that this is the number that they find without running, that they match to the theta.
So it's below.
So it would be this number. This green line is that classical result where they just took the amplitude and its perturbation to just solve directly for the
theta. Ah,
okay. So that's what this green line is.
Okay, so it's not too far.
Not too far.
So since you're doing two loops here, you must have.
I'm not doing two loops. Other people.
They are doing two loops. Are they doing the radiative correction?
Yeah.
Are both of that? Alberta was asking about? I mean, this is real science prediction, but you have to check
it. If you believe they're two loop running, they worry about the coupling of this thing to gravity.
So these are the radiative corrections.
Yeah. No, but they don't quantize the metric, right? So
they
just.
Well, they take that S parameter and they argue, you know what I'm talking about with that S, and then they argue that the graviton effects will be small.
So I don't know what's the S.
So they you have to define equal time commutation relations, and if you define them, this is the vector derivatives, so you define them, then you get an S multiplying your usual delta function. And that S basically goes as 1 plus pi squared over m squared c divided by 1 plus 6 c minus 1 pi squared. It's this expression. And then they argue that for low field values, it's just 1, so it doesn't really matter. You don't have to worry about couplings because of implied expressions. For large field values, it doesn't matter either. So it's not my argument, that's their argument that it doesn't matter, but they did think about it. So they did all state, they did some decent work on it, and they did the running of the top quark, and they did all the coupled runnings. So
okay, so the statement, if I write it in terms of phi run type operator instead of the phi squared r, the statement is that you can start with this particular operator, but you don't repeatedly generate other ones that could be destroy your efficiency.
Oh no, we're gonna have problems. there's going to be problems. This will deliver a bunch of problems.
Of this side.
Yeah. Okay. You don't even have an inflationary solution. I'm setting it up now that I'm going to beat it to death, right?
So but I thought what they did is actually worked in the Jordan frame, and then they say the alpha I squared, if you say you don't quantize the metric, then that's dimension two operator, and then it's renormalizable, and that's why they can do all this. But of course, you're cheating because you've got to quantize the metric.
Okay, the Einstein frame cannot
do it. Einstein frame, then it's clear, you know, it's dimension four plus an infinite number of big things.
So they're not making use out of this phi squared r in terms of the vertices, right? And it's just take it as a dressing or...
Well, I think they're doing something wrong.
I mean, the problems are going to be worse than the details of the loop and the running error. The problems are deeper than that, more basic than that. So it is interesting. I mean, it is minimal. We must admit it's minimal, right? It's just the same law degrees of freedom and gravity. And that term might exist. Isn't totally wild speculation, right? And it's realistically testable and falsifiable if it was all working. That's pretty cool. You don't even need any magic experiments with magic sensitivity variables. And but it's an extremely flexible potential emergence somewhere naturally. But all, you know, lots of pretty ideas fail. Now we're going to look at it with field theory and remember the constraints I was talking about, unitarity and power counting constraints.
Can I ask, what are the constraints on the phi to the fourth coupling when you introduce this non-minimal term?
Constraints in what sense?
But when you had minimal coupling, there was a constraint on the phi to the fourth coupling, and a lambda has to be 50 minus 15 or something.
Sorry, I understand your question.
When you had minimal coupling, when you didn't have this phi squared r term,
yeah.
You put constraints on the phi to the fourth coupling for inflaton.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that was tiny, like ridiculously small. Yeah. It has to be
when you introduce the phi squared r term,
yeah.
How do those constraints change? For
That's what this is. Right. That's where this constraint comes.
Yeah, that's exceed, but what are the constraints on lambda?
On lambda? Well, I think exceed is not.
Presumably, you can have a standard model.
But it seems going to be a large value.
Yeah. But I didn't actually see the constraint kind of room.
No, I didn't. I mean, this is just for exceed. It's just a large value.
I was asking the phi before.
No, but I didn't write down the constraints on that. But it's just, I mean, it's the heat cell coupling, which you know the mass. Once you know the mass. Anyways, now we're going to kill it. So, such as it is. So, power counting versus heat inflation. So, all we do is you just take the Hubble scale, and you just, from the potential that Einstein frame potential, remember, you get this square root of lambda and Planck over c. And you have it see from that classical result that I just showed you again, being this large number. So you probably think, you know, with unitarity, it's going to tell you where the theory is breaking down. You probably think the largest dependence on C is probably the origin of scattering that violates unitarity. So let's find the largest dependence on C. And power counting lets you do that directly. You just take the power counting formula, and you just look for the largest dependence on C. And you get, you want C is another two derivative terms, so you get this expression here. And then remember, we had topology in that low energy example that also related vertices, number of legs, number of loops. And they still have a relationship just like that. So you trade off your B to the ends, and you find, you just look at this expression, you want to have the largest dependence on C, so you have the largest dependence on B. So if you just start counting, obviously you want to have n equals 3. You should have 3 field insertions to get the largest dependence on C, and therefore the strongest dependence on, strongest. Unitarity extreme. And if you just take that value, what you're doing basically in power planning is Higgs scattering through gravitons and Higgs graviton scattering through a Higgs. And you get this amplitude, and then from unitarity, this has to be less than 1. Right? So you have that the energy has to be less than M Planck over C, and so the cutoff scale has to be less than M Planck over C. And people actually, I mean, the reason I'm citing the power planning here is people did get this cutoff scale wrong, and they didn't cut like 2-3 field insertions as a propagator machine. Calculated just 4 field things in the first papers. So is this a death blow?
So can I ask?
Yeah.
So this, how can one get a large C, right? Is by, for example, having lots and lots of particles in the loops, right?
That's one way, yeah.
And then we know,
some
of course,
very large engagement.
That the cuddle will go down, right? In a few main species. Quite natural, right?
Yeah.
From just
general argument that fits kind of request to the rule.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I mean, the very thing that makes you think this might work, which is this large coupling, is also what's killing this sort of idea. Large amount of C. So is this a death blow? And it really is. So you have this cutoff scale for M being M Planck over C, and you have the Hubble scale, I remember. So we have this adiabatic constraint that H over M has to be less than 1, and now we have applied in these that it has to be greater than the square root of lambda. So that's when the unitarity plus the adiabatic constraints are valid. And the two loop running that they did, then you can just get a value for lambda, it's like 0.02. So you might think that maybe there's an unknown number, you're just doing power counting and you're not actually getting numbers exact, you're just getting scales exact. So you might think that the number will come in and help you and change the relationships. It's not going to help you much because it's already 0.02. But people have actually calculated explicitly partial wave unitarity calculations for scalars coupled to gravity, and Willenbrock did that. And they actually get that the number is pi over 6 square root. So now you have one calculation in the effective theory. It's the same effective theory that calculated in. So you know quantitatively what the cutoff is now. We know that that number doesn't help you. So you have this small window, and it gets worse. Because Higgs inflation relies on there being this phi h dagger h squared term and a non-minimal coupling term of this form. They're playing against one another. So for Higgs inflation, it occurs when you have h dagger h getting this large value. But of course, part of the motivation, to be fair for this, was that people were thinking that there's nothing else besides the Higgs. And so it's not surprising when you couple any particle to a scalar field and get into trouble. It's just a hierarchy problem. But you can't prove it by internal symmetries, this operator, right? This is another scalar field. This isn't the Vonnegut normalized Higgs field. It's just a new scalar field. You can't forbid this. You integrate it down, it's going to give you these contributions to potential and the contributions to the function sitting in front of R. So these have to be highly sequestered. These have to be very small compared to that C and small compared to lambda. And so, you know, you have to have a desert. You have to have something else, basically, for this to work. And the cutoff is M Planck over C. The exponentially flat potential was for M Planck over square root of C. Right? So that's where the exponentially flat, you know, somewhat natural region was coming about. And that's, of course, parametrically higher than the cutoff scale. Right? So this we pointed out that this cutoff scale was lower than people thought, and that there's no exponents of Merdons, and the argument that you could actually make a stronger conclusion. And so we really don't know the potential for the field values where inflation is said to occur. So this theory has to go over some other theory at the cutoff scale. At M Planck over C, something else takes over. So you don't have that relationship between, you know, you can argue about the way they did the running, but the point is the relationship breaks down. It's just, you know, at that cutoff scale, you don't know the low energy accelerator data, which was running up with your running solutions. You don't know the relationship you're going to get with the spectral index. It just cuts off, it has to go over something else, and you don't know what happens. So you break the relationship. So you can also use power counting as a general tool to attack R-squared inflation if you wanted. And this is just a simple illustrated example to show you that it is a more general tool. And it's a simple example to do. I mean, there's actually an exact relationship between these R-squared theories and these non-minimally coupled theories, like it's in that Bond paper. But we just did something simple where you just integrate in a scalar and you use this equation of motion, you put it back, you see you get back this Lagrangian. And the same arguments apply when you just rewrite the theory in this way, the scalar field, you just make a mapping between the Higgs field and this other scalar, and lambda h to the fourth and p squared. And you have an xc squared being related to the zeta now, so zeta is an even bigger number. We just go through the same arguments, you do canonical rescaling of the Einstein into the Einstein frame potential, you just write it down in terms of xc. You have the Hubble scale, when you calculate your unitarity. It's actually easiest to calculate this in this theory. These are equivalent, right? So just do graviton scattering in that theory. You get the cutoff scale, just like before. And you find another small window of a valid effective field theory, where this is 1 over 20 and this is 1. So the same sort of argument can be used to investigate other
ones. Yeah, I think you mentioned this, but how can you relate an energy for collisions with the Hubble scale.
So I don't think
this
energy here came into so this energy. No, the energy is relating. That's the point. Right? The energy is not relating to the Hubble scale. It's relating to the cutoff scale theory. So you use the energy, and that you integrate the stuff out to generate this low energy effect of Lagrange. So the cutoff scale and the energy tells you when these other degrees of freedom have to come in to then fix up unitarity. So relating it to M.
So you're relating it to M. Phi value, actually. But well, M is just a parameter. So you're saying phi should not be that.
M is a real max, right? Relating it to that scale.
Okay.
So this comes in. In the Hubble scale, you just know from the potential.
Sure, sure.
Right. So there's no magic. Really, yeah.
There's a confusion that we're not really in inflation doing scattering amplitude and some fixed
energy. That's my confusion.
Well, but if you have an effective field theory, so you can calculate scattering in that theory and say, where is the regime of validity of this effective theory breaking down? Mm-hmm. People should be doing this to make sure that what they're doing is sensible quantum mechanically.
But that has nothing to do with inflation.
Oh, but it does, because we just showed you that you do the scattering in the theory and it has a cutoff scale, but which is below the scale of where you had thought you had this inflating solution. So if you just do your inflation and you don't think about scattering, then you get into trouble. That's the point here. Right? You have to think of this as a consistent effective field theory, which has a cutoff scale. Mm-hmm. And you have
it's
to
cut off in energy. Right, so that's the cutoff in energy. So that's a particular process which is the scattering.
Yeah, but it tells you that the cutoff scale of the Lagrangian, that theory is a sick theory above that scale. You cannot use that theory anymore.
Maybe the thing is that the park bank he gave, it made it look like he was doing momentum integrals everywhere, but really it was just dimensional analysis. If you had done that calculation in the de Sitter space of what the correct Celsius reaction would have been with the de Sitter propagators, all that was really going into that argument was that you had one scale characterizing all your graphs, and in that case it would be H or something. Mm-hmm. The same power bank would go through. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that inflation is some sort of a scattering in some sense?
No, I just think you have a cutting corrections to your action based on
just a self-consistent
estimating of
the
other size.
Okay. Just the argument of where is the theory self-consistent? So let's take that. Let me get to the conclusions. So on the plus side, I think that it's interesting, right? Something like it might be promising that it somewhat naturally gives you an exponentially flat potential, which is, you know, hard to do. So maybe some more model building should be done trying to overcome these problems, but it's hard to imagine it work. Because it is nice, and it could relate maybe the properties of scalars measured in accelerators to properties you would measure in W-max. But it's as Maxim said, I mean, the very coupling that is leading to this possibility of this exponentially flat potential is what's leading to the cutoff scale being so low. It's intrinsically sick as an idea this way. And we find just using power counting and unitarity, these self-consistency regions, but it's really worse than that, which is that the cutoff scale is so low, you don't actually know this inflating, it goes over to some other theory. And it's sensitive to new physics when you integrate it out, and it's problematic to imagine it actually working. So I think that's it. That's it. Further questions?
Did you hear anything back from the proponents?
They wrote a paper actually afterwards saying that it's not that unitarity is breaking down, it's that it's becoming non-perturbative. And if it's becoming non-perturbative, well, then you should have other mass scales, other modes, right? You can have some sort of
becoming non-perturbative. Mode. How can they justify that potential?
Well, yeah, it's not my argument, but that's what was done.
So they made a vision statement.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's thank Michael.